Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where both Rebecca Huntley and Tanvir Ahmed make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. Our topic for discussion tonight is listening to the nation. What do Australians want most from their government? And so both our speakers are well known, but I'll introduce them briefly. Rebecca Huntley is a social researcher and an author. Her previous book was Still Lucky. Her current publication, Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation, which has just come out as a quarterly essay. Tanvir Ahmed is a psychiatrist, practicing psychiatrist. He's also a commentator, currently writing for the Australian Financial Review every month. And his most recent book is Fragile Nature, Nation, Vulnerability, Resilience and Victimhood. That book came out about a year or so ago, but we've got copies of both books here tonight. So we'll lead off with Rebecca Huntley, then we go to Tanvir Ahmed, and then we go to questions and discussion. Rebecca, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming this evening. Thank you also to Anne and Jared for inviting me back to the Sydney Institute. I realise this is actually my fourth time coming to speak here. And I guess that means that both of you probably disapprove of what I have to say, but will defend my right to say it. And more than that, provide me with a platform. So I'm incredibly grateful to both of you for your generosity and your continual commitment and contribution to intellectual life in Australia. I made the decision as I was thinking over the last couple of days about what to talk about, not to talk too much about my quarterly essay, which is a cunning plan to get you to buy it, but I'm sure there will be lots of opportunities in the questions to address some of the things I talk about in the quarterly essay, and I want to kind of come at it, that content, from another direction. I know that tonight I'll be sharing speaking duties with Tanvir, and so I wanted some of my comments really to connect with some of the things that interest him about stress and mental illness, as well as the experience of some people who would be make up his patients in the refugee and migrant communities. Now, these issues are not unrelated to my quarterly essay. I spend quite a bit of time in it talking about affordable housing in Australia, which is a major source of stress pretty much for everybody, young and old. And I also talk about general community attitudes to new migrants and asylum seekers in that essay. But my starting point tonight is to talk about young Australians, their concerns, priorities, and how that might play out politically, especially in the next couple of weeks. As many of you would know, there is now a record number of Australians who are enrolled to vote. It's almost at 97% of eligible voters on the roll. I think we've got to be proud of that, certainly in terms of advanced democracies around the world. That in part is thanks to the highest enrolment rate in history of young voters. Some of you would know that around 100,000 Australians enrolled to vote in the lead up to the same-sex marriage survey. The majority of those voters were under 25 at the time. This is a bit of an interesting side effect the No campaign probably didn't count on. So at the moment, about 18% of the electoral roll is aged 18 to 29. And traditionally, in the AEC data shows this very clearly, that both in terms of enrolment and participation of young voters, there's always been a bit of a deficit in the late teens and early 20s. And it's going to be really interesting to see if they make an impact at the next federal election. Not for a moment wanting to generalise about what young voters care about, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Let's see, first of all, whether, in fact, young voters are concentrated in any seats of interest, so does it really matter what they think, and does this kind of influx of voters into the system make a difference? What is interesting is the ABC hack team have kind of crunched the numbers on this and found that, in fact, the highest proportion of young voters are in the suburbs of capital cities, not the inner city. We tend to associate young voters with the inner city. Now, they might drink and socialise in the inner city, but a lot of them can't afford to live there. A lot of them are still living with their parents. Sometimes the parents don't know how to get them out of, of the house. It can be quite tricky. The exception to this trend are seats covering inner city Brisbane, and of course Queensland's going to be of real interest in the next election, and to some extent Melbourne, where you have these large student populations. The other areas where younger voters are really concentrated is in the all-important seat of Herbert in Townsville, held by an incredibly slim margin by Labor's Cathy O'Toole. Interesting for two reasons, Townsville, I'll be talking about that in a minute. It's where Clive Palmer's nickel mine has fallen over, and also lots of interest obviously there in terms of the Adani mine. Lindsay in Western Sydney, held by Labor's Emma Hussar, retiring at the next election, is also on a very slim margin. And in both of these seats, about a quarter of people enrolled to vote are under 30. So really interesting marginal seats, lots of public interest and lots of reasons why you might have swings really to different parties in those seats. The other seat where young voters hold power is in the seat of Dixon, Immigration Minister Peter Dutton's seat. Again, a tight margin, about 1.7%, or almost 1.7%. I'll talk about Dixon in a minute. And Labor's Anne Allies, her seat of Cowan, on less than on 0.7%, and Attorney General Christian Porter's seat of Pearce, also marginal. So all of that stuff is kind of online ABC's HACS website. Now, it's only really in two of these seats that I've recently done qualitative research. Townsville is an interesting place for a lot of reasons. My family, on my mother's side, are from northern Queensland, so I've got a soft spot in my heart for northern Queensland. Townsville has really been hit hard economically, also by issues around crime, youth unemployment. And when I was there to do some research, I met two young men who were apprentices. Well, one was apprentice and one was working in a coffee shop. And we were talking, their big issues were job security. That was their biggest issue, job security. What was interesting talking to one young man who was working in a coffee shop is he said that any one week he might get 4 hours of work in the coffee shop, and the next week he might get 35. He said that renting and even buying houses in Townsville wasn't expensive, but there was no way he was ever going to get a loan with that kind of employment situation. Now, he could move to Brisbane and get a full-time job, but he would struggle to be able to rent in Brisbane. So he felt like he was in a bit of a catch-22. He did want to stay in regional Queensland, but he was finding it hard to find a job. He was interesting. He questioned whether something like investment in mining with Adani was going to lead to the kinds of jobs that would give him any kind of permanency. Maybe more people buying coffees, but perhaps not. The other young man was an apprentice and was, you know, quite keen for Adani to be established. But again, for him as well, he was just worried about long-term longevity in terms of those jobs, and whether he would really be able to get any of the jobs that might be on offer. And again, similar kinds of issues in terms of how of being able to get enough pay to be able to move out of his parents' home. Both of them were kind of 20, and I think they were going to be there for some time. Dixon is an interesting seat. It'll be one to watch for a whole range of reasons. It's a seat that's changed over time where I've been going there to a place that feels like regional Queensland to now a place that feels very much like a part of Brisbane, an outer suburb of Brisbane. With the young people that I talk to and listen to in the seat of Dixon, the really big issues for them, other than job security, was the cost of uni and TAFE, and to some extent also the environment. So if there is indeed going to be a influential youth vote in marginal seats in the next election, you'll find a range of different issues determining those youth votes depending on where they are, but really common ones are things like housing security and job security. Those two, if two of those things are insecure, then young people find it extremely hard to plan for their future. Along with these kinds of very conventional issues around politics of concern for young people, there is almost one that tops the list pretty much whenever I'm conducting research in this area, and that's mental health. Nearly a fifth of people in Australia who use Medicare-subsidised mental health services are under 25. Any research I do with young Australians, mental health is listed as incredibly important, an area where they want government to address it as a matter of priority. They also recognise that it's not just government's role, it's our whole of community response to mental health that's needed. Whether it be anxiety and depression, kind of generally felt in amongst young people, or suicide rates in Indigenous communities, there's a real concern, not just for their own peer group, but for their peers in other parts of society. That impression that I've got from my own research is backed up by other recent research being done as well. Last year, Amos Washington, who's the Australian Youth Representative to the United Nations, travelled the country, ran about 152 consultations with more than 4,000 young people, and he found that mental health was the number one issue across all the young people he talked to, whether they were in universities or juvenile detention centres, and all kinds of community organisations in cities and remote communities. And in 2016, Mission Australia's youth survey found concerns about mental health across the country had actually doubled since 2011. That's a really big jump. About 22,000 young people were involved in that survey, and more than 20% cited mental health as among their top national issues. And it's not something that we normally think of as a political issue. We see it as a health issue, but it's becoming increasingly more politically important to young Australians. We've seen both major political parties spoken, and sometimes quite frankly and movingly, about issues around mental health and made commitments. Obviously, more can always be done. I suppose one area that's of interest to me is perhaps looking, any new government might need to look at the ongoing effectiveness of Headspace, which is a program that's had bipartisan support and a lot of funding since it was established and is clearly struggling for various reasons to have a model that can deal with the complexity of issues that young people are presenting, and also deal with the sheer volume of young people turning up to Headspace. There are lots of things to be dealt with there. Ian Hickey, who is an academic and one of the key architects of Headspace, said that it's been going for 15 years and it needs to develop more depth and sophistication. Finally, on this point about depth and sophistication in approaches to mental health, I want to talk about something which I think intersects with Tanvir's interests, which is mainly stress and mental illness in refugee and new migrant populations. I've spent quite a bit of time in the last 6 months doing focus group research and consultations in collaboration with translators and community facilitators in refugee populations in Western Sydney, looking at the issue of healthcare. A lot of the findings there have reinforced some of the work that I've done in those communities in the past. It's clear that refugees particularly, but new migrants generally, really struggle with navigating our healthcare system. It requires a lot of ongoing support and education. I think when they arrive, they get blasted with a lot of information, which can often be hard to absorb, and there's not always a lot of follow-up. There are obviously huge issues with stigma around mental health, more in some communities than others, and enormously complex mental health problems. What's really clear, though, is that the very fact of coming to this country means that family dynamics and gender dynamics change in refugee families and in new migrant families. The younger generation feels very much caught between wanting to be part of the new community and having to manage their parents and parents' expectations. They often become translators in the healthcare system. And gender dynamics change between particularly well-established couples when they come here as well. And sometimes that can lead to enormous amounts of turmoil in the family. Tanvir has written a lot about this and talked about it in the past, and of course I'm not a healthcare expert or a healthcare systems expert or a psychiatrist, but what was really clear in the work that I, in what I was hearing in those communities, that well-funded and staff community healthcare centres numerous points of contact within and outside the healthcare system to support refugees and as well as new migrants. And refugees who are able to improve or develop their English language skills, so to kind of develop their own capacity to navigate the healthcare system, which, let's face it, we all sometimes struggle with having to deal with. And also those able to both to navigate and adapt to changing family and gender dynamics that necessarily happen when they come to Australia. That if all of this was possible, they are able to achieve the best healthcare outcomes. Obviously, there's a lot that governments at all levels can do to facilitate that, but there also has to be a whole of community approach to making that happen. I know that Tanvir has some more practical experience with the best approach here, and I'm looking forward to his response to some of the things I've said and any other musings on politics as well. Thank you.
Tanvir, thanks very much, Rebecca, and it's a pleasure speaking to you all this evening, and thank you very much for coming. A special thanks to Anne and Jared, who have been long-term supporters, and I think gratitude, certainly, you know, we should all be giving gratitude for the forum they've created, and that was especially on display. I know recently I attended their big dinner, and there was just a fantastic energy in that place, and you know they've created something very special from the ground up. Yeah, absolutely wonderful. Now, I also thank them for seeing Rebecca and I as something of a double act, given we've spoken together at a previous event and last year, and especially she very much, it's her publication is very recent, so I'm thankful that I've been included when really it's her publication that is utterly current. I do think there are similarities between our work. I mean, I see myself very much as a socially oriented psychiatrist. And for all the biological breakthroughs in better understanding mental illness, the roots of it, certainly the rise of it, and the greater discussion of it in public affairs, as Rebecca was alluding to, I think are primarily social. Family breakdown, said rise in loneliness, decline of collective identity, be it through religion or nationalism, the decline of a moral language, a withering trust in institutions, unfulfilling jobs. And I think what's especially interesting about this is none of these problems have easy left-right solutions, political solutions. They're less about individual rights and more about our institutions, our attachments, and the nature of our relationships. I read Rebecca's excellent essay, and I commend it all to you, as something of a pining for a better social democracy, and what that might look like today in quite a different economy and society to, say, the Halcyon days of the Labour movement half a century ago. I think in some respects, Bill Shorten is doing a good job in that, arguably in the last couple of decades, social democratic parties around the world probably strayed too far to the right economically, certainly for their base, and possibly too far to the left socially. And as someone who was in Young Labour at university, I would certainly say that social drift was probably a factor in some of my political evolution, if you like, or political maturity. Now, my observation is both sides of liberalism, let's say economic on the right and social on the left, have been tremendously successful. You know, the rise in prosperity across the world is historically unprecedented. But likewise, the greater freedoms and opportunities for people of all ilks is extraordinary, and I'm a great example. I'm the child of Bangladeshi immigrants. My parents grew up in Bangladeshi villages, effectively, and the opportunity, the elite education and the social mobility that I've been offered in a country like ours is really quite extraordinary, and it wouldn't happen in too many countries around the world. And both those liberalism have in common a celebration of individual choice and fulfilment of desire, and arguably an ambivalence to human association. And I think that a pointer to many of the issues going on today, especially at a social level. Now, look, I want to talk about two issues today that I think illustrate some of the challenges we face and that overlap with my work and interests, and also possibly, I guess our session was called, you know, Australia Cultural Divides, and this may be these two topics, suicide and white flight, I think touch
on some of these issues. And both are linked to the challenge of retaining attachments and belonging. Now, arguably, mental health, the term, is a sort of rational, scientific-sounding term that sits atop the swirling sort of psychological and social undercurrents engulfing Western society. It's the interior psychic maelstrom that sort of gives rise to potentially movements like Trump, Brexit. I know Israeli philosopher and author Yuval Harari argues the crisis of Western societies is one of great prosperity sitting alongside a lack of purpose. Now, we heard Rebecca talking about mental health increasingly become a big issue. I would argue it's largely because we've increasingly lost a language or other ways of conceptualizing problems of living, be it a moral language, be it a metaphysical language. And increasingly, we make sense of our lives through the language of psychology. And this is partly when people think of problems in their life. Mental health is kind of a catch-all and a very loose term, arguably, younger people especially use. And in fact, studies in the US, when they've looked at college students, they've raised sort of moral problems, etc., and they've found increasing young people barely have a language to discuss these sort of issues. And arguably, my profession is partly to blame that we've increasingly medicalized such a great deal of day-to-day living. Now, in some ways, mental health has wider implications because it informs our view of human nature, especially the limits of our resilience, free will, and the nature of responsibility. Its definitions carry great importance, particularly in the disability and legal sectors. Now, suicide in particular is never just medical, but goes to the heart of human existence. There's no other species that must make meaning of their lives beyond their biological needs. Now, medicalization can help to reduce stigma, but risks building future generations inept at discussing their experience in moral or metaphysical terms. Arguably, suicide also highlights the limits of liberalism. Now, last year, the suicide statistics are always quite difficult to interpret, but certainly last year's statistics came out, there was a 9% in overall increase, and quite certain demographics, notably men in their ages 45 to 49, recorded quite a significant increase. So there's certain segments that are clearly showing quite frightening growth, which is a real cause of concern. But arguably, suicide highlights a kind of a limit of our system. It's the dark endpoint of the prioritisation of individual autonomy. The act exposes the weakness of a political system that doesn't necessarily offer any guidance on what should constitute the good life, nor does it make attempts to provide strong basis for collective purpose, arguably leaving a gap to be filled by the politics of dignity and identity. Now, it really doesn't make much sense that disorders like post-traumatic stress can triple during the most prosperous and peaceful time in human history. I'd argue mental health diagnoses are offering new ways to conceptualize suffering, and not always in a helpful way. One of the things I talk about in my book is this term called concept creep, which is really the dilution of terms like trauma, bullying, addiction, and often those terms are diluted with good intentions. The view is that more and more people will be brought into the net and they might seek help. But arguably, I would argue, it's increasingly made us more sensitive, and it's part of the reason we have this kind of almost really sensitized public life, where increasingly people feel threatened, they might feel victimized, and not only that, they feel like the source of it is external. So the modern climate, and you know, writers like Sir Christopher Lash and many others have talked about this for decades, you know, the modern climate is by its nature therapeutic and not religious. People yearn for salvation through personal well-being, health and psychic security. Most can't see how politics might contribute in this regard, which is why modern parties, particularly when connecting with affluent groups, often must speak in a language beyond the economic. Now, that hasn't necessarily happened much in the most recent election. Now, it's also why some of you will be familiar with the most recent Productivity Commission review in Victoria, especially around mental health. And one of the focuses of that is the workplace. And many of you will be especially interested in that. And I think the workplace has become a more charged environment to transmit sociocultural debates. It's the primary site of self-fulfillment, especially for younger generations, and especially as we become a service economy, well, we are a service economy, as the service sector becomes more dominant, the stakes in the office around self-presentation and interpersonal relations are heightened. And I see a lot of, I do quite a bit of work assessing claims at work, and you really get a feeling of that, of these heightened kind of stakes at work for in terms of personal well-being. Now, I know the title of the session is around cultural divides, and I guess the other topic I really wanted to talk about is around some of what I see around both ethnic groups, refugee groups, and, say, working families, what we might call working class. Now, I think some of the divide is noticeable in my work. Certainly, you know, like my social circles of professional educated classes who arguably, for the most part, have progressive views. Meanwhile, while my work is among immigrant groups, the underclass and working families, mainly Sydney's West, as well as the jail population, where I often do assessments. Now, I don't think our divides are quite as great as, say, the UK or the US, where you've essentially had, in Henry Kissinger's words, non-violent revolutions. Now, we're wealthier to some... I think we have been wealthier in the last decade or two. We're less unequal. We probably sit in the middle of the OECD, as measured certainly by the Gini coefficient. And our skilled migration focus means we probably have, I think, considerably better integrated ethnic communities. And that's really a credit to our migration policies. And I often like to bring up the statistic of mixed marriages. And Bob Birrell, the Monash researcher, found that the city of Sydney has one of the highest rates of mixed marriages in the world, in the Western world. And I think that's a great marker of us having a greater deal of cohesiveness, that ethnic groups aren't kind of scattered in so-called ghettos, if you like. But some of the elements that have arisen around the world are also here. There's certainly, and I guess what I wanted to allude to was this idea of white flight. And many of you remember Luke Foley bringing up the term. It did cause a great deal of controversy. And even in my work, I actually wrote a column about white flight, and I was being published in the Fin Review regularly. I remember that was about to go in the paper, and literally hours before they said, oh, we thought it needed a bit more, we were a bit worried about the sensitivities around that term. And it didn't get published. I ended up publishing it in The Spectator. But I was surprised by it. Like, I don't think I necessarily recognised the sensitivities around that term. But it's certainly something I see, where there's certainly an element of sort of white, blue-collar, feeling a bit of a cultural anxiety. There's a lovely word that I discovered during the whole Brexit debate called solastalgia, which means when home no longer feels like home. And the American researcher Robert Putnam also uses the term hunkering down. And this also overlaps with white, particularly in Britain, where increasingly communities where the native whites are a minority, that's where they're seeing the greatest movements of so-called white flight. Now, some of you know David Goodhart, who wrote a very influential book, The Road to Somewhere, a British writer, former editor of Prospect, that instead of left and right, the emerging fault line is between the well-heeled internationalists, which he dubs anywheres, and others strongly rooted to place the somewheres. Most of us lie in between. He described the internationalists as those with achieved identities based on educational and career success, which makes them comfortable with new places and people. The somewheres tend to be older and less educated. They're housewives, blue-collar workers, farmers, for whom modern upheavals are more distressing. And Goodhart writes that they've lost economically with the decline of well-paid jobs for people without qualifications, and culturally too, with the disappearance of a distinct working-class culture and the marginalisation of their views. But in some ways, so growing white flight seems to challenge this view of a proud rootedness, at least in Australia. Now, so the same groups most rooted to place are more likely to move from where generations of their families have previously lived. At a time where communities forged through work, shared interests, or technology dilute our geographically based identity. So at first glance, it potentially offers hope for economists and policymakers. Now, a challenge affecting sort of industrialised economies is that it's unrealistic to expect people of all kinds to uproot in order to take jobs in emerging sectors, especially as industries such as manufacturing decline. But if they are willing to move, perhaps yesterday's blue-collar worker may be tomorrow's pink-collar worker, say, in the caring sector, which is where so much of the growth in jobs are. And to be fair, I do see a bit of that. I'd work Bankstown a couple of days a week, and increasingly we do get more males working as disability workers. But the reality is probably less promising. Now, the move is less about work, even during that debate Luke Foley brought it up. I think he was trying to paint it as possibly economic. I would argue it's less about work, and it's more about recreating a sense of place. And the current Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, whose electorate sort of goes through Goulburn, Camden, he says he sees a great deal of this. And he used the term cultural sympathy. He says they're moving to areas that feel more culturally sympathetic. And he studied sort of electoral rolls, and he saw that many of the people moving were in areas like Punchbowl, Bankstown, Cabramatta. And he gave me this quote: working class life has definitely diminished. Local jobs are fewer. As we economies are essentially getting more centralised, so more and more of the jobs, as we become knowledge economies, the jobs tend to be even more so in the city. So we're not actually getting more decentralised. But that means commutes are longer, and this is creating a degree of resentment. And as I alluded to, they're moving to places that they experience as more culturally sympathetic, particularly with a view to where they want to raise their kids. So I think his observations mirror what Luke Foley said. Now, men in particular are more likely to move hundreds of kilometres in search of an idealised cultural identity and sense of masculinity than necessarily change sectors in the same suburb. So white flight is in some ways an example of a cultural, almost psychological anxiety, which I think touches on many of our issues of the day, especially around attachment and belonging. So I think we're going through a fairly extraordinary phase in human history, driven primarily by communications technology. Granted, I don't think this election campaign is the most inspiring around those debates necessarily, but the reality is that modern societies have a weak moral and political consensus. As a psychiatrist, I also think both sides of liberalism that have been very successful do offer incomplete pictures of the human condition and have arguably strayed too far towards individual rights and less, say, from human association. And I think that is arguably the challenge for our societies in the coming decades, at least at a social level. Thanks.
Well, many thanks to our two speakers. As I said, we've got copies of Rebecca Huntley's Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation, and a few copies of Tanvir Ahmed's Fragile Nation, Vulnerability, Resilience, and Victimhood. And so we come to questions and discussion. Rebecca, if you just come up here and just stay there for a minute, Tanvir, and then I'm going to move off and you can move in. So just, can I just get you both your opinion from what you've done as a social researcher, what you've come across as a psychiatrist? It seems to me that an interesting development in recent years is the concept of offence, that I don't think it was so prevalent. And not only you can almost win an argument now if you stand up, as someone did on Q&A, and they put it in highlights and said, look, I feel terribly offended by what you said, and that was the kind of the end of the argument. And then other people take offence on behalf of others, which is increasingly common. It seems to me this is a relatively recent phenomenon, not completely new, but it seems to have built up. How have you come across that in your various work? So Rebecca, and then Tanvir, and then I'll move away. Yep.
When someone says something's new, I always tend to try and seek a historical moment where there might be a parallel. I read The Three Musketeers, and they're constantly having duels because they're constantly offended about small things, constantly killing people. So I'm sure there were other times in history where there were kind of heightened sense of propriety or being offended on the part of other people. I suppose what I would say, I don't have a complete answer to this, Gerard, but I would say that I think we need to be careful that we think the charged name-calling on social media or on forums like Q&A really matches what happens in the broader community. So I can see what you're trying to say, that there's that rise of that I'm offended, no, I'm offended, and different parts of politics try and say that the other side is worse in this regard. I don't see it happening more broadly in the community. But then again, I would also say sometimes when things get said and it's really very clearly racist, sexist, homophobic, perhaps offence isn't the word to be said. And it goes to, I suppose, Tanvir's comment about that we need a new language to start to talk about some of these kinds of complex issues rather than talking about just defence or maybe talking about mental health. So anyway, like I said, my complete response to that.
Rebecca, you go this side.
Oh, sorry.
And Tanvir, you go that side. Yep.
So well, I guess I would bring up that what I was alluding to by the term of concept creep. I think it's an important term here. And certainly something see in my work. So let's take the example of something like bullying. So when it first arose decades ago, likewise in trauma, had a very specific meaning. Sort of object, for example, trauma in a post-traumatic sense, objective, life-threatening, had a certain level that it had to achieve. Likewise with bullying, had to be consistent, had to be repetitive, had to be intentional, and had to have some sort of measurable damage to the person that it was enacted upon. So arguably over several decades, those terms have steadily been diluted to more subjective measures, not necessarily one that has to be terribly repetitive. And there's been an increase in the importance of perceptions. So this is something I very much have to assess, where people increasingly accept their perceptions. So in any one room, any specific event, there'll be multiple interpretations. But increasingly, the subjective perception acquires a greater value and that it must be given a special weight for a lot of people. And this is certainly something you see in the workplace, especially a lot of claims, etc. The other thing I'd say, as we become more diverse, I think there is a lot more clash around certain value systems. And I'd argue, say, things like hierarchy, authority, these things vary quite significantly among different ethnic groups. And I'll give you an example of doctors. And I remember when I was a junior doctor seeing where this English doctor had just come to Australia and a nurse had asked him to do some photocopying. And he was taken aback. He was taken aback and he thought this would never happen in the UK. But he was able to sort of laugh it up and go, this is sort of the Australian egalitarian, yeah, all right, yeah, it was sort of this kind of stuff. But the exact same thing to an Indian doctor, he kind of interpreted through the lens of race, where he had quite a different sort of attitudes to hierarchy, but he saw that as, well, maybe is that a slight upon my race? You know, and he saw it as potential racism. So it's an example where perceptions and intentions, I think, vary quite a lot. But when combined with some of the sort of trends around how we measure some of these terms, be it, you know, bullying, trauma, addiction, with those things, I think it has made us a bit more sensitised. And certainly, some of you would have read Jonathan Haidt, the moral psychologist. He often talks about these big changes, particularly in young people. We're increasing, they're more likely to see even the terms like violence. Suddenly, you know, certain words, especially in sort of academic folk, they interpret as violence. But also, they're increasingly likely to see people as good or bad. So you have certain views that may potentially make you bad. So these are, to be honest, I don't necessarily see those trends on a big scale, like Rebecca, in Australia, I think. So maybe they have a particular context. But certainly those things like concept creep and what I see in the workplace and some of those changes in value systems around hierarchy, authority, some of those things, especially in a much more diverse society. So the interpretation of any single event will vary considerably in, say, a workplace or a classroom. So I think that does increase at least debates around, say, you know, racism, bullying, sexual harassment, etc.
I just add one more thing. I don't think the solution to what you might identify as a kind of a rise in everybody taking offence is for everybody to be quiet. If they're upset by something, I think the key is for us to develop more sophisticated forms of communication and to keep the ability to communicate face-to-face as a core part of how we communicate, not just online, which doesn't necessarily always have context. It's very easy for an argument to escalate online in a way that much, much harder to happen in face-to-face.
Thank you both for joining us tonight. It's been so interesting. In terms of national holidays, back in Mr. Hawke's time as Prime Minister, we all were reacquainted with the history and the heritage of Gallipoli. And it's become something that, having done national service, I I'm amazed at how it's connected with our society generally, but how would your intimate knowledge of new arrivals and people of other backgrounds, how would you, how have they come by that that holiday?
No, look, great question. I think it would vary quite a bit generationally. My experience, if I just think of my own parents, I don't think it was easy for them to latch onto shared narratives around, say, Australian mythology. And even Gallipoli, you're talking about, arguably, that's been quite generational too. It's only sort of younger people that have really latched onto it as a kind of national myth to bind people together. I think, and again, this goes back to our integration debates, and I think we've been more successful than most of the Western world, in part because we have a strong skilled migration base. And it's through the workplace, or even through universities to some extent, even there, although there's some questions around that too, but certainly in the workplace, I look at my mother, she probably took her 20 years to learn the national anthem, but she was at work, she did learn about, be it the food, the practices, what alcohol, the place of alcohol. I think when she first arrived to Australia, she just thought Australians were a bunch of drunks and they were just kind of, yeah. But she could kind of sort of see. So I think that exposure. But in terms of the broader myth, and I'd also say when I saw them go back to places like Bangladesh where I was from, they'd almost hadn't realised how Australian they'd become.
Yes.
Right? And then these are people that came, well into their adulthood. So things like, the ideas around hierarchy, for example, even though they're quite familiar with, be it servants, etc., you could see their attitudes had changed quite significantly, or how they'd speak a bit more, sort of a bit more direct, a bit more bluntly, that kind of stuff. So in terms of shared mythology, I do think they take on, I think most migrants do take on those civic virtues of Australian. I don't think it's terribly hard to be Australian, and I think it is very attractive, those civic qualities. However, in terms of shared mythology, I think that's changing dramatically. And I don't think we have a shared, is one of the points I was making. I'm not sure we have shared moral and political consensus at the moment, which is why we keep having these debates around, be it Australia Day or Anzac Day, whatever happens. So what we consider sacred is in flux. And that's arguably one of the biggest challenges in how we keep a society together. But arguably Anzac Day is one of the exceptions, I think. And that's partly, Yasmin Abdul-Majid, who, I sat on a board with and I was friends with, arguably that was an example of two different sacreds clashing. So for certain groups, this idea of asylum seeking, etc., that has almost a sacred quality of what constitutes virtue, that I care about asylum seekers, blah, 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 I'm virtuous, and likewise. So it was really two different sacred systems clashing, and she touched on a particular mythology that was especially precious, which really drew the blowback. I mean, regardless of the rights or wrongs of what happened there, I think it's a good example of how we have quite different streams of what we consider appropriate mythology or what is sacred.
Yes, definitely. Yasmin touched on two sacred issues, but the fact that it was her saying it was also a big part of that combination. But to your point, I think that idea of Anzac Day, I've written actually a bit about it, about the mixed feelings that the broader community have about it, but it's managed to make a bit of a transition in the public mind, perhaps much better than Australia Day, because there's almost a kind of an owning of some of the sadness and the loss as part of it, rather than just this sense of celebrating a kind of a crude nationalism. So it's gained in sophistication, and as a result, people feel there's quite mixed views across even generations about it. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a really thoughtful way to engage, and it means that that day becomes perhaps less divisive and less difficult for us to talk about than perhaps Australia Day. In terms of the one thing I would say about all my experience with new migrant and refugee communities is whether or not they buy or understand particularly why that day is important, they generally are extraordinarily respectful of it. They're quite determined to be generous and understanding about the culture that they're part of. So this kind of idea that they might not necessarily join the Dawn service, why we should expect that is odd, but I would just say that's generally the approach that they take to kind of national holidays of their new country.
Can I just add something here, Jeff? Just one term I would add that is worth considering, especially around Australia, is that the notion of asymmetrical multiculturalism. And this is a term that I think Rehan Salam or possibly Rohas Stewart, the New York Times columnist, I'm not sure if they invented it, but they've certainly used it. And this is the idea that it's essentially encouraged for all ethnic groups to really celebrate their kind of traditional identity, but it's almost discouraged for the white majority. So I think that is an issue in our community. So Australia Day does bring about some of these tensions where if the white majority is seen as celebrating their kind of native history and identity a bit too enthusiastically, it suddenly looks like it's diminishing the citizenship of others, and almost kind of that's when, you know, some people start interpreting it as a kind of racism or kind of imperialism of sorts. But I think it's a very interesting term. I haven't seen it used very much in Australia, but I think it's a useful term.
There's a question up here. Rebecca, just
yes. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned that there is a huge cultural divide in this country which hasn't been discussed tonight, and that is between the country and the city. The country people are our frontier people. They supply us with food and the miners supply us with minerals, and yet they're having an incredibly hard time because there is this divide of city people, particularly new Australians who have never been beyond even up to the Blue Mountains, let alone beyond, and seen the sort of frontier that they're battling with, the lack of water, the regulations on water, the lack of electricity in many places. It is incredibly hard as a country person. And to get city people, particularly new Australians, I think we need to have some sort of integration or program so that they understand what it's like to be a battler in the country. What do you think about this?
Are you suggesting that we bring new migrants into country areas to understand what it's like to...
Just to visit, yep. To host them, to show yep. them around. I've started doing it personally.
Right.
And it's just for, so they can see what it's like to be on a farm, which they thoroughly enjoy.
And parents yep. think yep. that when the refugee issue was a big deal under Howard, there was a rural movement for refugees, I don't even start it, and the thing that changed a lot of those country towns was that there were refugees settled there. It made a huge impact.
So the first suggestion is that people should be encouraged to go into the rural areas.
Yeah. Oh, look, all city people, regardless of their ethnic background, should understand what it's like to live beyond the city perimeter. There's no doubt about it. I don't know why new migrants should be singled out on top of everything else that they need to manage. I mean, obviously, it's a nice idea, but it's easier said than done. So there's plenty of examples of good experiences that refugees and new migrants have in regional areas, and also plenty experiences that are really difficult, you know. So we have to kind of acknowledge when we say those kinds of things, the whole issue of, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, racism exists across Australia regardless of where you are, but this idea that we're going to plonk new refugees or new migrants into regional areas.
No, just visiting. Yep.
Visiting is a great idea. It's a fantastic idea.
Tammy, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, just quickly. I know for several years I used to fly to Armidale and Tamworth, and I got a real taste of this. And arguably they were two good examples of it, of how differently it was managed, because I think Tamworth had a bit of a disaster where they brought in, probably too quickly, I think Sudanese, Eritrean, and it caused quite a lot of tensions. And the mayor came out, so we don't want them. And I mean, he looked racist, but generally it was managed poorly. There was too many. But Armidale had Middley's a different town, sort of university town, etc. Look, I think it is very important. I think in terms of broader national cohesion, and it sort of overlaps with the Goodhart categories, you know, the somewheres and anywheres, and very different sort of potentially attitudes. So Australia's especially difficult just because it's so, you know, spread out, etc. But I certainly hear your point. One thing I'd add about refugees, and this is certainly, especially in my work at Bankstown, it's a very close part of my work. And it's difficult for me to say this, but I think modern economies make it much tougher to integrate refugees. Right? So a half a century ago, you turn up, bang, you go to a factory, you didn't need English, blah, 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 and you rise up the ladder. Suddenly in advanced economies, knowledge-based economies. So ANU did a big study, came out, I think, 2014. I can't remember the name, I'm sorry, but you know, he looked at refugee groups over 5-6 years. The employment rate after several years was less than 20% of the group he studied. So, look, obviously most of the children tend to do better, but they're also often from traumatic backgrounds, so there's a lot of problems there too. So as much as we'd like to have a big humanitarian program, in my experience, you have to spend a lot of money, but integrating Vietnamese migrants in the 70s is not the same as integrating Iraqi Eritrean refugees in 2020, and I think that needs to be considered.
Getting close to the end, Christian, you've got to be brief.
Yes, thanks for coming to me. Just getting back to more younger voters, this campaign, the parallels between 1972 and when the Messiah in Gough Whitlam came along, is remarkable.
Are they really?
RMD.
Why do you feel that?
I learned a lot of ancient history. That's all right. I'm just wondering, though, do you think when the young ones get a taste of what a bit of socialism is like, that this period of the advent of the shortened government will have, in every sense of the word, a cathartic experience on the electorate?
Can I give you some advice? Don't ask them questions, they'll answer them.
Look, I just, all I have to say is to kind of echo the words of the great Russian leader Lenin. Anything the Australian Labor Party can come up with is so far away from socialism that we can't even... the Labor Party is not suggesting socialism. And certainly, in fact, Bill Shorten and Gough Whitlam, very different kinds of characters.
And Rhea, do you want to make a comment on that?
I'm not sure. I'll try. I don't know who said the quote, but every generation, you know, learns the hard way that socialism or communism isn't the answer. I don't think Australia shifts very much. I remember, some of you will know Tim Andrews of the Taxpayers. His wife effectively fled Australia, Helen, and she said the ideological debate is so bland here that she just couldn't kind of survive here. So, look, realistically, we're not going to shift that much. And sometimes I do, ultimately all our measures are amongst the best in the world. So I don't think we're going to suddenly fall off a cliff, even with a shortened government.
Tammy, don't walk away now.
Sorry, okay, we've both got to stand here because the camera is...
Are you telling you this or not?
Sorry.
Is it going to be brief? We might be the last one, okay.
Thank you, Gerald. Let me ask a question. You both mentioned about there's a problem with the mental illness among the population, especially young people. And you mentioned one of the reasons is they do not have a good opportunity to have good jobs. And I just heard read on the paper, Australia actually we're giving like skill visas for 150,000 skill visas every year. So I'm wondering, Australia is very good at education. Why the government cannot fund those education educated those young people before they consider bringing people from overseas?
I don't have any policy expertise to respond to that. All I can say in terms of the young people and job insecurity question is you've just got this kind of, you've got a great divide between people who perhaps don't have the kinds of skills and education that they could get in this country, and so they're really kind of stuck in casual part-time jobs where they're actually not going to have much progression. But even the very big thing I hear from young Australians who are well-educated is that that kind of move from leaving university to getting a full-time job is perhaps not the easy transition it once was. There's quite a lot of unpaid internships. So there's kind of an uneven development from a great investment in education to jobs. It's not saying that there aren't young people in jobs and doing well, but there's this general sense across the spectrum of job insecurity, not just hitting young people, but it's all that they've ever experienced. So unlike baby boomers who would have had some well-educated ones would have had a progression, certainly in their early career, that's just not something that young people experience. In terms of the government and unskilled visas, no idea. Do you have a response to that?
Look, I think with young people, look, definitely that's, more than anywhere, that's where I would see the rural-city divide. Yeah. I know that young people I was seeing, say, in the country, you know, big difference. Like if you're well-educated with skills and you live in a place like Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, really, it's a bit of a playground. Potentially, yes, you know, housing's expensive and you may have casualised work to an extent, but, I mean, people with skills tend to don't necessarily mind that because the opportunities are there. But there's a huge gap when you see the equivalent people in country towns, even reasonably prosperous country towns. That's where you really see the whole thing of amphetamines, lack of opportunity, suicide. You see this real, there's a real sense of a malaise in those sort of environments. And I think, I've forgotten your name who raised that. And that's really one area. If you looked at relatively unskilled youth, and, tertiary educated city folk, like that's the one area you'd see one hell of a cultural divide.
Mm-hmm. Now, give me a very brief final comment. Yeah.
We've had about 40 or 50 years being analysed by social scientists and scientists. And I wonder to what extent this is now the problem. You talk about younger voters as a group. I'm sure a lot of younger voters have different ideas about what they want to do with them, what they want to do with their vote. The other thing that's happening is that people are living much longer, so we've got a much larger number of older people than we would have had back in 1972.
Yep.
So to what extent is our problem with people being mentally unwell, rather than ill, that they are overanalyzed, and it's all the fault of you scientists and scientists?
Okay, so what, I don't understand your use of... I don't think there's anything...
What I'm saying is it's a very complicated world. I understand a lot more about teenagers now having had lots of grandchildren, and I know the mental health issue from very close at hand. But to some extent, I believe it's got a lot to do with the expectations they feel that are placed on them and the frightening awareness of just how fragile is their safety levels. So they hear so much about this and that and who they are and where they might be.
Yep.
Everyone's labelled. Everyone's got to be in a group. And to some extent, they make their own sacred cows. So when something happens, whether it's about vegans or it's about justice in for gays in wherever, they get really emotional, and that then brings down on them, a feeling of inadequacy.
So what's the alternative?
I don't know.
I don't think that's our fault. I think that Tanvir and I are just trying to listen to Australians and to try and find frames to understand what we're doing. The rise in anxiety amongst young people, whether it's an issue around perception or fragility or feeling overwhelmed, and understandably there's a lot of reasons to feel overwhelmed. Sometimes when you think... why they're upset. I think it's because they're paying attention to what's around them. So I think the question is not necessarily whether it's the problem of analysts. Perhaps the question is that some poverty in the kinds of language we as a society talk about these kinds of issues. So Tanvir's comment that we use the mental health frame to describe a whole lot of problems which may not necessarily be located in our own individual psyche, like issues about loneliness, lack of social cohesion, lack of being part of a community, this whole idea that you're defined by what you do as a job and how much money you make. Given the older we are, the more likely we are to spend large parts of our life not working or only with a tangential connection to the workforce, these are all enormously complex issues, not dealt with by saying that we've got to give up identity politics or we've all got to kind of subsume our sense of frustration and anxiety. We need to become more sophisticated in how we talk about it as a community.
And the final comment?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a great answer, Rebecca. What I would add there, well, I guess one of our core points is that psychological element is adding to the broader politics. So, for example, you take inequality, for example. We traditionally measure it, say, Gini coefficient, incomes, but increasingly it is psychological. It's about status anxiety, sense of fulfilment and esteem. And the fact is we're all wealthier. Someone on a disability pension now is wealthier than 95% of the world.
Yeah.
That's an example. And I think to Anne's point, I would say one of the big challenges and something I see in my work, there is enormous pressure on young people, arguably more than any generation before. So on one level, they're in the most prosperous, peaceful times in human history. Yet there's this pressure for self-realisation is intense. And I think that creates a great deal of pressure. And I think that's one of the core points, arguably both of us are making. On one level, there's this argument for more social democracy, and I'm arguing at a psychological level, the focus on politics we've had on fulfilling human desires, be it economic or social, is increasingly part of the problem.
Yep. Many thanks, folks. We could go on all night, but time is upon us, and I've got an important I've got an important interview with my shrink, so I've got to.
I'm not Bill Carey, it's all right.
So look, it was a fascinating discussion tonight, and as I said, we've got copies of Rebecca Huntley's book and a few copies of Tanvir Ahmed's book. They're both covering some of the issues they've covered tonight. It was a great explanation of contemporary Australia. I learned a lot, and I'm sure we all learned a lot and enjoyed ourselves. So well done, Rebecca. Thank you. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.